This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Pongo Alliance is an alliance of oil palm growers, businesses and NGOs who aim to make resilient landscapes for wildlife and people by seeking ways to allow lands outside protected areas to play a role in conserving wildlife. So I'm going to find out more about the alliance from its executive director, Dr. John Payne, and also Dr. Felicity Oram, who is the Kinabatangan Project Director for the alliance. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm fine.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just to get started, you know, can you tell me who are the Pongo Alliance? Tell me about the work that you both do through the Alliance.
I need to give a little bit of historical background. The origin of this Pongo Alliance, which I'll describe in a moment, dates back, I guess, about 7 or 8 years. And it's centered on some individuals in what I call NGOs or civil society organizations and some forward-looking people in or linked to the palm oil industry in Malaysia and Indonesia. And the discussion amongst these individuals informally was how do we get to go over this dreadful thing about oil palm versus orangutans, and orangutans are being killed by the oil palm industry. And there were a number of informal meetings in Malaysia and Singapore in particular of these individuals. And the upshot was eventually at the end of 2017, some of that group decided to formalize our discussions initially by setting up a company. So there is a Malaysian registered company, Pongo Alliance and Durian Bahad. And then, of course, with that, you need directors. And so what happened was that those at the beginning of year 2018 who were still on board in these discussions said, okay, we're going to work together in some sort of way. We focused on the Kinabatangan area of Sabah, of which more later as our focal area on the ground. But I think I want to now outline or just list the partners, because this is a unique partnership of organizations and people that wouldn't normally get together. So I'm going to take the liberty of listing them out in an alphabetical order. So the partners are Aid Environment, which is an international consultancy, essentially environmental consultancy. There's Accenta, which is an Indonesian civil society organization with a special interest in oil palm. There's a company, one of the pioneering and most forward-looking oil palm companies in Indonesia, Ostindo Nusantara Jaya, and they're exclusively Indonesian-based. Then there's Borneo Rhino Alliance, which is where I come in, because Borneo Rhino Alliance, of course, its interest was rhinos, but we're now thinking that other large endangered mammals in Southeast Asia should be part of our attention. There's another Indonesian oil palm grower called Bumitama Agri, which is largely in Kalimantan. There's an international commodities trader, including trading in palm oil, called Bungi Lotus Crocland. There's Copenhagen Zoo. There's Hutan, which in this instance means a Sabah-based, community-based NGO, which has been active in Kinabatangan for more than 20 years now, focusing on orangutan conservation. There's Musim Mas, which is a Singapore-Indonesia oil palm grower and trader. There's Orangutan Land Trust, a UK-based NGO that's long been interested in orangutan conservation. There's Sawit Kinabalu, which is an oil palm grower and palm oil producer, wholly owned by the Sabah government. There's something called the Southeast Asia Rainforest Research Partnership. There's Saim Dabi Plantation, and a French organization called the Alliance for the Preservation of Forests. And finally, in our current partnership is Wilmar, which you may know is also a grower and international trader in palm oil. So all those people come together. We talk to each other through our steering committee. And Juliet, you mentioned our vision statement earlier, which is a very general one, our vision. Still, I want to stress that the origin and the focus, at least as of now, is on how to allow the oil palm sector contribute in the long term towards orangutan conservation. I also want to make clear a couple of other things. We, despite this being basically an industry NGO arrangement, Pongo Alliance does have a memorandum of understanding with the government of Sabah, and in particular, our partners there are the Forestry Department. because orangutans need forest, and of course the Sabah Wildlife Department. So there is a formal government blessing and interest in what we're doing. And I also want to mention at this stage that in addition to those partners who put up an annual partnership fee, which allows us basically the admin to run the organization, that's one thing. But we also rely on donors who allow us, particularly Felicity and her team, to work in Kinabatangan. And those are Yayasan Saim Dabi, Unilever, which gives us a grant through WWF Malaysia, more on the habitat restoration element, and the Alliance for Preservation of Forests that I mentioned earlier, which is a donor as well as a partner. So I think that's how we are as of now.
Okay. Like you said, you know, that's a bunch of groups that you wouldn't always see collaborating. So it's wonderful that you've all come together for this initiative. Maybe, Felicity, you can tell us a little bit more about your role as the Kinabatangan Project Director for the Alliance.
Yes, I was very lucky as I completed my PhD at the University of Malaysia Sabah in 2018, quantifying wild orangutan survivorship in collaboration with one of the Pongo Alliance partners, Hutan, and looking in this very highly altered landscape of the Kinabatangan in eastern Sabah. And then I immediately was very lucky to begin work with Pongo Alliance in 2019 to look on the ground at how orangutans are not only using the protected landscape, which I really focused on for my PhD work, but also how they need to also use the private landscape as well to cross between forests that are now islands within an oil palm agricultural landscape. My current work with Pongo Alliance is a twofold task. To better understand orangutan use across the landscape, the protected privately administrated landscape, and to engage oil palm growers as collaborators in wild orangutan conservation.
Okay. And John, is there anything else you'd like to add with regard to the role that you play within the organization?
So I'm British. I came to Sabah in 1979 and I worked with WWF Malaysia. And as it turned out, I've spent most of my life and my working life since then. And in the 1980s, I did take a look with the Sabah Forestry Department. What at the time seemed nothing major, but in retrospect was important, which was a statewide assessment, the whole of Sabah, on the distribution and approximate numbers and how orangutans were faring at that time, which set an excellent baseline. And essentially, the finding then that was... You know, people always ask for numbers, but there was of the order of 20,000 or so orangutans in Sabah at that time. Almost all of what we now call, in our Pongo Alliance context, the Kinabatangan landscape, 90% plus was still forest, albeit logged. And the first big-scale oil palm plantations were coming in at that time in the 1980s. And in fact, in 1984, when I was still in Kinabatangan, Sandakan with the Forest Department, the Sabah government in 1984 made a very profound policy decision, which is quite rare, which was that half of Sabah would stay as permanent forest reserve and parks and sanctuaries, and the other half would be made available for development. So there's been no personal interest, even though I operate through Borneo Rhino Alliance, there's a personal interest to sort of see what might be done, given that landscape that I've just related. Basically, it's reverse now. Now about 90% of the land is oil palm and 10% is forest and villages. So that's been essentially, I must stress, it's a personal thing, but it's through my role in Borneo Rhino Alliance that we took an interest several years ago in joining this Pongo Alliance.
Okay. And how would you say the orangutan conservation landscape has changed over the years?
Well, there has been a dramatic shift in the space of about one orangutan's lifetime, which is about 60-odd years, from a forest with small indigenous fishing communities along Sabah's largest river. And that has shifted over time and over the time that John has worked here, as he mentioned, to largely a landscape that's dominated by oil palm monoculture, with larger and smaller, various sized islands of forest within that landscape. And then all of those remaining forests within the landscape have also experienced some degree of selective logging. So there is dramatically less forest now, and there is concurrently dramatically less orangutans there, because orangutans are a forest dependent and actually the largest habitually tree living mammal. So without a forest, you can't have orangutans in the landscape. So we have less orangutans than we had before, and we have less forest. But in terms of politics, the gazettement of the Lower Kinabatangan Wildlife Sanctuary in 2005 was a tremendous positive move for conservation, and quite a visionary thing on the part of the government, in my personal opinion, that was, of course, shepherded and spearheaded by many people. But to enact as a protected area a discontinuous group of small forests, fragments across a big landscape, is an amazing thing to do, because usually people tend to want to gazette large areas of pristine forest. But what this did in 2005 is that it really made a situation where orangutans had refuge in the landscape. Mm-hmm. And so it halted the loss. And because of that protected area landscape, we still have a potential to have viability in for orangutans in the landscape today. And this is also really important, because these areas along rivers are the primary habitat areas of orangutans. Historically, they exist at highest densities in these kind of riverine lowlands.
Okay. Before we go any further, though, I mean, maybe we can do just a quick 101 on why orangutans are so special, you know, why they are so important in their ecosystems in Borneo and Sumatra.
Okay. Orangutans are Asia's only great apes. And together with the African great apes, we as humans are in the same taxonomic family. So there's a pretty natural interest that we have in this species. But orangutans are the most exclusively tree-living of all the great apes, and they are what I like to call optimistic frugivores. That means that if there's fruit available, they're going to eat fruit. But it doesn't mean that they can only survive on fruit. And in fact, they depend also on leaves as the protein source. And really, they eat pretty much all of plant parts. They eat flowers, they eat the inside of the inside bark, the vascular layer of trees, they eat the pith, they eat the young shoots. So they are plant-eating species, and they rely on trees and vines for their food. They do also eat termites and ants, but they are also found mostly on trees. So orangutans depend on trees for their food. Orangutans also sleep in trees. Every night they build a nest in a tree. They don't sleep on the ground. They live in a tree. And it's a very comfortable type of bed that they make fresh every day. And orangutans also are unusual compared to people and also other great apes, is that instead of eating in groups, they tend to eat on their own. So they're called what we called in science solitary foragers. That means if you see an orangutan feeding in a fig tree, you're probably going to see just one. Sometimes you see other members of the family, but they don't eat in a restaurant situation or in a large group. So this makes orangutans very difficult to study, because they tend to be in the landscape very spread apart. You've got one orangutan feeding in this tree over here, one orangutan feeding in that tree quite far away. You may not be able to see both at the same time. So orangutans tend to be very sparsely distributed at a very low density across a wide area. So this makes them, even though they may have a small number, they require a large space because they need to be spaced apart. And also it makes them quite challenging to study, because they're in the tree, they're up in the air, you have to strain your neck to watch them, and you have to be covering quite a large area. You're often only watching one at a time. So it really wasn't until about 10 years ago that we really definitively knew much about orangutan social structure. And the genetic work that was actually initiated in Kinabatangan, but then we can know that what we learned in Kinabatangan applies to the orangutans throughout Borneo in Sumatra, which is the remaining places where they now live, is orangutans' social structure is built around resident females that live on their ancestral land, and they raise their offspring in fixed locations. And that male orangutans grow up, when orangutans live a very long time, and they take a very long time to grow up. They don't reach maturity until they're 15. And at that time, a young female 15-year-old will settle down into her mother's and her maternal relative's range and raise her baby. And then if you're a male at 15, you are going to leave where you were born, and you are going to live a much more migratory life span, where you move between forest patches now. When the forest was one large forest, they moved over wide areas in a continuous forest. But now they need to move between smaller patches and need to move across a landscape that has changed, which is no longer forest between. So what we are trying to do in Pongo Alliance is facilitate the normal social structure, which we call metapopulation structure, which needs to operate over distance. But that landscape has changed to where the forest is no longer continuous, but its patch is across a landscape.
So is that what sets you apart from, you know, other programs that are working towards orangutan conservation?
Yes, to some degree, but in many ways, the key difference that sets us apart, I think, is really that we are a collaboration between conservationists and oil palm growers as collaborative partners. We view this as something we need to do together, and that is one difference. So we take the evidence-based science that we know and then work in a much more social science, I guess, way to understand what are the challenges that oil palm growers have with this species and how can we meet both our needs, so that we're acknowledging that humans exist in the landscape as well as the wildlife. The other thing is so, I mean, as John explained in his introduction, we in all ways are a collaboration across what would traditionally perhaps not be people who would talk together. But on the ground, this goes all the way through that. And we are also different than many straight orangutan research organizations, because our work is much more applied in nature. So we take the work that our colleagues who are working at more basic biological aspects and apply that in a practical way.
Okay. I'm speaking today to Dr. John Payne and Dr. Felicity Oram. They are both from the Pongo Alliance. John is the executive director and Felicity is the Kinabatangan project director. And they're telling me more about the work that they are doing through the Pongo Alliance. And we're going to find out more after this quick break. You are listening to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. On the line with me today are Dr. John Payne and Dr. Felicity Oram. They are both from the Pongo Alliance. Dr. John is the executive director, and Dr. Felicity is the Kinabatangan project director. And we're finding out more about the work that they do. So earlier before the break, we were talking about, you know, why orangutans are so special, and also what sets Pongo Alliance apart from, you know, other programs working towards orangutan conservation. But, you know, on that note of orangutan conservation, you know, what are some of the greatest threats to orangutan survival in the wild?
Well, the greatest threats to orangutans' survival in the wild is quite simple. Orangutans need forest habitat to survive, and so they need to have space. And orangutans need to not be harassed by people or killed by people. They are by nature, as a wild species, quite shy of people and really try to stay away. And what we have seen in the first year of operations in the Kinabatangan project is really the orangutans are doing quite a good job of trying to move around in the landscape and to survive in these smaller forest patches. And what we need to do on the people side is we need to do what we can to try to support what they're trying to do. So I guess, I don't know if it's a threat or it's a challenge for us as people, is how to agree to accommodate the needs that they have so that we can share this landscape together.
You know, when we think of threats, we tend to think of things like logging and oil palm, right? But the biggest threat really in many spheres of human endeavor is changing in mindset when you want to introduce a paradigm shift. So I just to amplify what Felicity said, in a way, I wouldn't say a threat, but a big challenge is human perception that we don't have to do certain ways to do conservation. And in this case, it happens to be big areas which are more oil palm than forest, which can sustain a metapopulation long term because of the forest still there. And that's you know, it's a human challenge, a change in mindset. But I did want to add one more thing that was missed, simply this, that whereas, of course, as you might guess, it would be ideal to all bits of forest left in the Kinabatangan, in this case, we'd hope will be there in the long term. But there is also is an element of this project which involves restoration. And by restoration, we mean specifically cultivating and planting orangutan food plants in that landscape to top up what's already there. So it's a very much a long-term thinking. Because, of course, when you grow a plant, it takes 10 or 20 years to be a mature plant. And in this case, the challenge is even greater because we're focusing on orangutan food plants, which are figs, lianas, and other sort of non-traditional forest restoration species. And we're trying to plant on steep slopes, rocky areas, swamps, stream sides, the sort of bits of an oil palm plantation which are not productive or don't have palms. So that's an interesting extra element in the program that we're doing.
And that's fascinating, right? And we're going to get into that more after this. But all palm plantations, you know, I mean, I think most people would agree that the conversion of forest habitat for all palm plantations, that's one of the major threats to the survival of orangutans, or at least that's how it seems to many, right? But, you know, no one can seem to agree on a solution, you know, scholars, environmentalists, journalists even. So some argue that all palm plantation agriculture is ultimately harmful to the environment. Others have argued that sustainable all palm plantations are the best route forward. What are both of your views with regard to this?
Yes, I think I'd like to make two points in response to that. So the first point is very much big picture historical. As human beings, we see what we see in our own lifetime, which is 20, 30, 40 years. And for us in Malaysia, the big thing we see, a lot of forest is gone and now there's oil palm. That's happened many times globally. So if you went to, you know, for example, to China 5,000 years ago, you'd see a lot of forests being cut down to plant rice. And then in Europe, it would have been 2,000 years ago, cutting down the oak forest to grow potato or wheat in that case. And in Malaysia, 100 years ago, it would have been cutting down to forest to plant rubber. So I find this, you know, oil palm element of the story is actually quite misleading. It's more the time in history when the natural habitats, there's a wave of conversion for the human use. And that's what we're seeing. Having said that, I also want to highlight and put my strong support for both the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil and the Malaysian Sustainable Palm Oil Standards. And I say that because they're an interesting pair. As you all know, RSPO is a global voluntary scheme which self-polices and changes its own guidelines and rules. So that's a voluntary way of improving, let's say, we use the word sustainability, but it means doing the right thing, I think, is a better word than sustainability. So we have RSPO doing that, and that's the pioneer. And that's quite rigid, yet open to change because it's self-policing. And then we have the Malaysian palm oil standards, which is superficially the same, but in many ways very different because it's a Malaysian national government level mandated scheme with similar aims. And if I boil down to the implication for orangutans, in our case, it means setting aside, albeit small areas, what they call them HCV areas. And basically there is a criteria in RSPO and a similar one in MSPO to look at rare endangered and threatened species and what individual oil palm estates can do towards conserving orangutans. So those are the two points. Now one is look at the historical context, not just think of oil palm, but on the other hand, we have in Malaysia, as well as globally, two pioneering schemes that help the, in this case, oil palm industry to do better than it might have done otherwise in terms of wildlife conservation.
The only thing I would add would be to again bring back to John's talking about the paradigm shift here. Traditionally, agriculture meant exclusion of wildlife and complete transformation of the environment. So the paradigm shift that we're fostering here in Pongo Alliance is also a shift in including animals in the landscape in a reasonable way, but also supporting a better environmental practice in agriculture. I mean, there's many people who work within the oil palm industry, and in over the year that I have now been in the landscape a lot, I've learned many things about innovations that many of the agronomists who are working in the oil palm landscape, they're looking at ways to reduce the cost of fertilizers. And there is becoming a movement to that it's economically a good idea to plant more sustainably or more in an environmentally friendly way. And it's certainly a better thing to do for people and the wider, you know, the neighbors, and the neighbors include the wildlife. So I think doing this in a more environmentally friendly way to look at a biodiversity and also the environment is a good way forward.
You know, the I was reading the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. They stated that oil palm is alternatively seen as a gift from God or a crime against humanity. According to science, though, it is neither. Could you help unpack that statement for me with regard to orangutan conservation?
Well, the first sort of thought is this is a, and it's good that you brought this up because this can be very polarizing. And you say the word oil palm and people make quite an emotional response. But first of all, oil palms are a plant, doesn't have a morality. So it doesn't in and of itself inflict anything on the landscape. It's really, this is a social science issue. This is a people issue rather than a plant issue. And as John said earlier in to the reply to the previous question about the focus now is on the tropical areas because oil palm is providing a product that is needed, palm oil, and there is a need that this agricultural crop is filling. It's no different than the needs that other agricultural expansion filled different needs. Wheat to make bread, you know, and all these other kind of things. So the main point is that we can't really put a morality onto a plant. It's really how the humans choose to act in the landscape that's really the issue.
Like John said, you know, the biggest threat or the biggest challenge, of course, is human perception and making that paradigm shift, right?
Right. And the perception that agriculture has to mean a complete hijacking of the landscape so that it's then taken over through this different purpose in totality. Of course, that may be the simplest view, but as we are learning more and more, in order to maintain these changed landscapes, we have to do a lot of intervention. So maybe we can change the way we look at that type of intervention and make it a more holistic kind of approach where it benefits both people and wildlife and the environment.
And what role do you see private landowners and businesses playing in this, you know, in preserving rare wildlife species?
I'd like to give a sort of philosophical answer. So if you look at, I mean, not only Sabah or Malaysia globally, in the long run, what you tend to see, whatever the legal system is, most of the land and most of the best lands, you know, the flatlands, coastal lands, valleys, become privately owned for human use, and you leave the forests in the hills. And really, if one wants to think, I'm thinking of orangutans, but the bigger picture, all endangered species, somehow, if one wants to avoid extinction of these big animals that need big areas and a low population density, somehow, in principle, the big landowners, which in our case would have to be oil palm plantations, have to play a role, not necessarily in everything, right? There are many things either that will be fine in Mount Kinabalu Park, or, you know, civet cats are quite happy living on village edges, but things like orangutans, which need big land areas to sustain the metapopulation long term, I think as a matter of principle, these big land owners do need to play a role. They're not in short-term projects that just sort of do a little study and that's the end of it. Make a long-term commitment to allocating part of their land to conserve, as I say, in this case, the orangutan.
And the Pongo Alliance is working in the Kinabatangan landscape area, as we've spoke about earlier, right? And that is, again, to create a human and orangutan coexistence landscape there. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, you know, the work that you're doing there specifically?
Well, specifically, we, as I think we've mentioned a little bit throughout the interview so far, is orangutans are, to a bit of people's amazement, are persisting in this landscape. And fortunately, there's been a lot of study on what they're doing and how they're doing this. So we actually are in a situation in Kinabatangan because of the various actions to create protected areas, the fact that, that people are studying them, the fact that there are generally well tolerated in the landscape by the people who are from that area, and is that we have a population that is a sustainable number. We know that we have a possibility to have a viable population, even though the landscape has really changed. We are also learning over the past year, we have some very visionary oil palm growers who are open to this concept of coexisting with orangutans, even if maybe their neighboring commercial partner doesn't agree with them or making fun of them. They want to have an open mind of this. So we have a situation where the population is quite well understood and is being monitored for many years. So we kind of know where the trend of the population, which is in areas that are heavily patrolled, it's quite stable. In areas where it is less patrolled, that doesn't mean that they're completely safe, but we're still losing animals, but not at the kind of rate that we used to. So we have an opportunity here. We also are very lucky in the landscape, because in the type of landscape we have in Kinabatangan, it isn't a peat landscape, so that the rivers and the actual landscape features are very much still in place. So male orangutans can find their way through the landscape, even though it's changed.
You've explained the kind of work that you're doing there, but and you mentioned the orangutan populations is quite stable at places where they're heavily patrolled. But what is the wild orangutan population in the area like currently?
Well, I'm really reluctant to use specific numbers, okay, because measuring orangutans is very complicated, and it's quite complicated also when you have them in a fragmented landscape. Mm-hmm. I'm shying away here of giving you a precise number, because when you measure orangutan densities, you'd never have a precise number. Mm-hmm. And so what I can say is that we have an orangutan population in the Kinabatangan that's diverse enough and large enough to support the idea of long-term viability. We also have evidence over the past year that males are moving around in this landscape quite well, and much to the surprise of many people, and that there are females that live not only in the protected forest, but within the forests, within the private landscape, that are raising offspring normally. And so we have good reason to be hopeful in this landscape. Like I said earlier, all the evidence we have so far is the orangutans really are trying to do their part. And for the most part, these degraded forests also are adequate to provide food for orangutans, because when you selectively log a forest, those species that are of commercial interest are not species that orangutans depend on. So these forests are not left devoid of some level of orangutan plants. But the other thing is, as John mentioned, there is even interest in the landscape not only to coexist with the orangutans, but to actually improve their habitat in the private landscape, which is an amazing thing. So there is also areas of goodwill that maybe more than I expected in the landscape.
And speaking of these landscapes, can orangutans survive in exclusively monoculture production areas?
No, because the orangutans, just like people, we can't survive no matter how much we may like to on KFC alone or one item, food items. Orangutans require a very diverse diet, and therefore a monoculture is not something they can live in, whether it's any type of monoculture. And they are a completely forest-dependent species.
And so the orangutans who are surviving in these isolated forest patches or these mosaic landscapes, right, I assume they play an important role in sustaining the long-term viability of the local metapopulation, which is something that you were talking about earlier.
Yes. I mean, like I said earlier, orangutans actually live and operate their society over distance.
That's right.
So the males need to be able to move between the forest patches. Otherwise, we won't have reproduction. We won't have genetic diversity. Yeah. And the females and the offspring need to have an adequate habitat in order to support them. And of course, the males, when they move through the landscape, those small forests that may not be rich enough now to support a female to live, they also need to support the migrating males. So the fact that we have interest in the landscape to enrich the landscape with the right kind of plants in a broader range of species range so that they can be supported is really important. And the fact that we have that kind of interest is really commendable.
A lot of the orangutan conservation efforts, you know, a lot of it has to do with translocation, you know, taking orangutans from areas where there are plantations and moving them to protected areas, for example, right? But do moving these individuals through translocations, does that actually weaken their overall metapopulation health?
In a nutshell, yes, because we don't quite understand how male orangutan social structure works. But we know they need to move around in the landscape so that if we see an orangutan in an oil palm landscape, and this happens where people find an orangutan in these, you know, 5 kilometers from the nearest forest, the assumption would be that he would be lost and in need of help. What we are finding out now in actuality is that this is the normal pathways that males need to move between forests, and he's likely not lost. You just didn't know he was there before. And so that if we take our males from one area and we move them to another, we don't know what we're doing to that normal metapopulation structure that needs to function across that distance. So, of course, when you see an animal where you don't expect to see one, it's very normal to be concerned and worried and feel that they need help. Perhaps they don't need help. And the other assumption is that if we find an orangutan in a small patch, we assume that she can't possibly live there because it's only, say, 44 hectares. But what we are finding more and more in the, at least in the Kinabatangan landscape, is these areas are quite rich and they are supporting these animals and they have supported these animals. And these animals are not only supporting themselves, but they're supporting their offspring as well. So the idea is to keep them where they are and support them where they are. Just from the biological perspective is to assume that the species is functioning as we would expect as a biological entity from the metapopulation point of view, as you said.
So I guess, you know, all this ties back to what you are working on, you know, to create that paradigm shift both in agriculture and conservation practice, right? That is also to do with metapopulation and all of that. How do you hope to create that that paradigm shift? We keep mentioning, but, you know, how do we hope to create that?
By a lot of talking on the ground.
I can't
imagine. It's a lot of talking.
Yeah, I think I'd intervene to say the same thing in every words, right? There's no way this paradigm shift is going to be fast. In Felicity's case, it's talking to people, building up trust, links long-term. And the bigger picture is the same thing, even corporate level. It's a sort of, it's a multi-year paradigm shift. It'll take one generation probably from where we were a couple of years ago to what we would hope for in the wider landscape. In this case, the whole palm oil industry hopefully is on board.
Mm-hmm. Felicity, anything you want to add to that?
As John mentioned, to reinforce, it very much is on both sides. It's not only on the corporate world, on the oil palm grower side. It takes an evolution in the thinking of my colleagues as conservation biologists as well.
Do you think that we can find that balance, you know, between, as they say, planet before profit, you know, between economic gains and also preserving forests?
I have to believe that. I'm an optimistic person by nature.
And the only thing I'd add, I think, is that we would hope for a balance, but the reality is that given that many species, not only orangutans globally, not only in tropical rainforests, depend on forests, you know, if we look in the long-term future, the more forests that are left, with a little bit of restoration as well, the more species will be saved. I don't think probably humanity can choose the balance in advance now, but that should be our aspiration. keep as much forest as possible if you want to save as many species as possible.
And allow that as part of your consciousness, because there's a tremendous caring for wildlife. People like to know these animals exist in the world, but the actual face-to-face encounters with them, for the people who actually have to live next to these animals, it can be a very different situation. And in many ways with orangutan, we are fortunate because wild orangutans see humans as something to fear, and that often helps us in coexistence in a funny way. So it's a willingness to address it in all avenues. So it's one thing to call for the saving of a species if you don't have to live with it. And so that's another part of the work that is the challenge to do this, is that you have to be very open to address the challenges as well and try to come to good solutions, which is why this is a very good approach that we're engaging as equal partners with the people who are the main administrators now of most of the land. Mm-hmm. So it's that coexistence is also between the people and the various interests, like you said, between a good environment, a good economy, and trying to make that balance happen. It's challenging, but we think as a people we can do this. We hope.
Yeah, because, you know, that whole us versus them sort of approach obviously didn't work. So it's wonderful to see, you know, the corporations also being open to these sorts of discussions, to these sorts of collaborations, and also the conservationists, you know, everybody coming together to work through this. But, you know, it doesn't sound like very easy work, and I think it's also very long term. So how would you like the public to get involved, or is there any way that we can support the work by the Pongo Alliance?
We have a website. It's actually under a bit of renovation at the moment, so check it often, and that gives you a lot more information. That's kind of the quick answer. But I suppose for the general public is to remind people that the wild population of orangutans, they're the fully competent wild population. You very often in the press, you hear about their ambassadors that live in captivity, or you hear a lot about rehabilitants who live kind of in a in-between life where they were sadly orphaned and have to have a much steeper learning curve to enter back into the forest. And there's a lot of efforts and attention focused towards those orangutans. So how you can also help is to remember and to support also those wild orangutans that are actually still completely functioning, and have faith in them, because I think all of us who are wild orangutan researchers, we're every day impressed by what we see, by what they are trying to do to adapt. So sometimes people can view this species as pathetic or in need of help, when actually, when you have the privilege to see what they can do in the wild landscape, you have great respect for them as a member of our taxonomic family with humans, and how they are trying for their own self-determination. And so people need to remember that part of orangutans. And also, I think most importantly, I work with every day oil palm grower staff who are from the sustainability teams and various teams. And these are people who are working in the oil palm industry. You know, they are in a profit-making industry, but they are committed to understand better about what wild orangutans need. They are doing great work at economic expense, either to give their staff time to help me, to participate in planting of native plants, to participate in recording sightings so that we can understand better how they need to use the landscape. So there's tremendous work that I do every day with tremendously visionary oil palm growers. And I think that the general public, maybe particularly the international one, who want to say that every person who works in oil palm is horrible, I'd have to say that's not my personal experience. And they really is the key partners in wild orangutan conservation in the landscape. So acknowledgement that we don't live in this black and white world. So all oil palm is not horrible, and all conservation is not horrible either, because sometimes when you engage with agriculture, they say, oh my gosh, I don't want to talk to a conservation biologist. I don't want to, you know. So that acknowledgement, both sides, that there's progress.
Okay. John, any last message you'd like to leave us with as well with regard to that?
I think the only thing I'd like to say is this. As noted earlier, this is a long-term paradigm shift. We have, I don't know what it is, less than 20 partners now. There might be other growers who are thinking of being partners. Please don't give up on us or this concept, because it is going to take a long time. And I'd make a particular note of Sime Darby Foundation, which was our first donor. They took a big plunge in a project that might or might not work out from their point of view. If you stick with this concept, it will take a long time, but it will work out, I believe.
All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Dr. John Payne. He's the Executive Director of the Pongo Alliance. And Dr. Felicity Orem, she is the Kinabatangan Project Director, also at the Pongo Alliance. And they were sharing the work done by the Alliance. And if you'd like to find out more, again, that website to go to is pongoalliance.org. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcasts on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.